The Tea Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop In.
I'm Ben Allen. Welcome to The Tea Stop In. Clara Chong is an incredibly talented and experienced director. She's done work for some of the most famous brands in the world and worked with people like Spike Jonze, Yo-Yo Ma and Jack Thompson. She's the director that I've worked with more than any other, and she's also my wife and business partner. Clara, welcome to the Tea Stop In.
Thank you. I feel at home.
A lot of people have said over the years that the dynamic between a director and a cinematographer is very much like a marriage. I guess we kind of ended up taking that beyond the metaphor, didn't we?
A little bit.
So we've been working together now for, I think, 17 years?
17 years, yep. We worked together on three different projects before we ended up going out together.
Mm. But now married, I think, 11 years and with two kids.
Yes.
When did you decide you wanted to be a director? And there was a bit of a gap between when you made that decision and when you were able to start pursuing it, wasn't there?
Definitely. I think there was a bit of a gap between me understanding what a director did and making that decision. I remember my mum asking me, you know, we have doctors, we have a lot of these academics in my family, what do you want to be? And I said, I want to be a director, I want to direct. What was
involved?
So
how old were you?
I was six then.
Six.
So I was probably being very precocious. It's only a year older than our youngest daughter.
Yeah.
My mum, during the time that my parents were headed towards divorce, I think the way that she escaped that was she went and saw films. And so she, having been born and brought up in Japan, she had a preference for a lot of the Japanese films, but she also loved a lot of pop culture films. So she would literally just take me with her to everything. In order for me to go after what I wanted within my family, especially with a single mum raising two kids and as the eldest, there was no way I was going to be allowed to just do what I wanted to do without actually having some sort of academic background to supposedly fall back on.
Yeah.
Studies were very much the honourable way to succeed in life. And when I realised I had something to say creatively in English, those presentations you had to do were, I remember, I think I chose one time to present both sides of a legal argument, but not that I have any legalese in my mind at all, but it was that art of presenting, you know, not as an actor, but as a storyteller. And I found that so exciting. You know, my assignments at school were always these massive visual presentations. I think that sort of became the way I researched for projects as well. You know, I ended up doing an honours in international relations at Macquarie Uni, but I joined the, you know, the uni drama club, and we made these really bad soap operas on campus, and we'd meet. I think we were so cool because we were discussing filmmaking and the craft and everything, but it was all an entree to, you know, actually going after it. Yeah, yeah, because once I graduated and got my degree, got my honours, it was the most freeing thought that I'm going to be able to do this. How do I do this?
And how did you do it?
I remember cold calling a couple of production companies in Australia, and I had a couple of nice meetings, but they kind of weren't leading anywhere. So I had to start thinking, being a bit more pragmatic about it, going, okay, well, I know I have my Japanese language skills, and there's probably going to be a greater demand for production assistants that could speak fluent English as well as Japanese. Given my family was in Japan, I decided to just take off and try my luck there, not knowing anyone in the industry and just, you know, having this dream of wanting to be in the film industry.
Mm. And so that those bilingual skills did actually enable you to get some opportunities in Japan.
Oh, for sure. It was an amazing experience. One of the first things I worked on was like the, I think it was the 10th International AIDS Conference, and then followed by like Baraka.
Wow.
They'd finished most of the elements. I think it was Osaka and some parts left, but I got to go to the cast and crew screening, and it started a whole journey of some really big high-profile projects that I worked on. I worked with Spike Jones before all of his films, but he was still the next hot thing. And he came with Sofia Coppola, and there was Vincent Landais as producer. So I met his whole team, and Lance Accord was the DOP.
And I guess, you know, in that capacity, you got to see different directors in the way that they worked.
Yes, I did. Actually, particularly there was a Hong Kong director called Larry Hsu. His style was incredibly precise and technical. And watching what he did, and people like Spike Jones, and there were a lot of, you know, Japanese directors as well that I worked with. And you pick up a lot. You learn so much by being on someone else's set. Everyone has a different style. And I learned very early on that to be a director, you had to find your own way of communicating with the crew. It was the utmost of importance to be a good communicator. But the creative side, the technical side, was something that you had to find your own way to bring together so that you can present the vision that you have.
And through those years in Tokyo, how involved were you in the technical side of things?
Very involved, because I was lucky that the bosses that I had were very gender blind. I was never made to feel like, okay, you're a girl, so you can't do this. Quite the contrary. William Word, who's a creative at heart. And I remember always watching him like suffer with the admin side of things with his production company, just going, oh, I hate this. And I remember swearing to myself, I would never have my own production company.
Yeah,
that came back to bite me. But during the quiet times, he would sit me down and literally go through the history of film and video. But this was not only just 16mm, 35mm. It was also down to audio equipment, audio mixes, Ampex versus Moviola editing system, and all of that. He drew diagrams. I have a lot of that still. And he taught me how to operate the vectorscopes and all of that. He never shied away from explaining something technically to me. And Richard Kipnis as well, you know, he came up through news. So he was a very fast editor. And this was in the days where, before digital. So it was all analog technology. Tape to tape. So if you change a shot, you might lose half a frame. And so you better be sure if you want to change a shot there. But that made me, you know, how to make decisions quickly and how to understand how to tell a story. This is a news report. You have very limited time to pull together a whole story, but you have to make sure that research is sound as well. And then show the shot. So I learned what a master shot was. I learned what a cutaway was. I learned, you know, in how to use B-roll and the difference between A B-roll. So all of that. And then going through on the post-production side, the D1, D2 suites that we used to go through. When you're young, you can pull crazy all-nighters. So that was a long, condensed, but, you know, I'm talking about 7-8 years that I lived in Tokyo doing all of this. So it was an extraordinary opportunity to be there.
And it's interesting looking back at that period of time where, you know, I was in a lot of ways having similar experiences at a regional TV station here in Australia. But looking back, it's easy to forget how rare those opportunities were. I mean, now a lot of that information you could Google if you choose to. Mm. But back then, finding those mentors who could explain things to you and getting hands-on time with very, very expensive equipment, that was a pretty amazing opportunity.
It really was. And actually, Scott Hancock, who I worked at MediaSense with, another American production company in Tokyo, he was also extraordinary. He was always so incredibly busy. We did a lot of work with Coca-Cola Japan during both the Atlanta and Nagano Olympic Games. And, you know, I was flying back and forth from Atlanta. I remember one occasion where we had to set up a edit suite there in order to, you know, get a project done. And he just, you know, sort of went, well, why don't you do it?
And, of course, tape-to-tape editing, we're not talking about something that's as simple as setting up an edit room now.
No, this is U-matics, Betacam. It was everything. And it was a massive, massive operation. So, yeah, it was literally being thrown into the deep end.
So you had this incredible lot of experiences there in Tokyo. From there you went to New York. Why was that?
I reached a point there where there was everything that went through Tokyo, so I loved the opportunity to do all of that. And I'd been allowed to direct a couple of things, so that was fantastic. But after, you know, 7-8 years, it was drama that I really wanted to do. And documentaries were a great way to sort of step into another world. But I wanted to write about fictional stories. And I realised the time had come where, yes, I had a lot of on-set experience, but I wanted to understand more about the rest of the filmmaking experience. And so afters as well as London and Canada, there were all these places I was thinking of. And then I remember I was at a friend's place for a going away party for one of my good friends, Stefan, and I finally met his other Australian friend, Viv, who turned out to be an amazing photographer and who was moving back to New York with a boyfriend. And she said to me, look, if you're ever in New York, just look me up. You know, you always have a place to stay. And I thought, fantastic. And then, you know, when I was looking at the film schools, suddenly I realised New York became a possibility because of that. You know, you just, when you're young, you really just, you just go for the experience. You don't think too hard, which is, I think, what you need as well.
Mm.
And it's that arrogance of youth that we sometimes talk about in that it's not a negative thing at all, because you have to be, you have to think, I can do anything.
In order to go out there and
I can be anywhere, do that, And if you don't have that, then it's going to get really hard when you do start going on the roller coaster of the film industry, as everyone does.
Yep.
Because when times get tough, it is tough. And if you don't truly love what you do, then you bail, you know. And then you're out of the running. You don't have the rest of the opportunities that go with it by sticking with it.
Yeah. So you've told me one story about your time in New York at film school there, about your encounter with cinematography.
Yeah. I did a film course at NYU, and it was amazing because you have people from all over the world as your classmates, and they're all like-minded. And the nature of being at film school is that you try out different positions. And on one of our major projects, I was chosen as the cinematographer, which I willingly went into thinking, I can finally use what I'm learning about lights and lenses and cameras and put forward some ideas. But, oh, my God, I was terrified. It's like directing. I have no qualms at making decisions about, you know, where to frame, where to put light, whatever it is. Mm. But knowing that I was innately responsible for turning that button on and buttoning off and making sure the images were in the can, I've never, ever been able to get back to remotely thinking that I could ever do that again.
Wow. And we're talking here about the days when, if you wanted to be a filmmaker, that meant working with film.
Yes.
And before the digital revolution really kind of got into gear.
Yes. I think we're shooting with 16mm, but we're wanting to shoot PAL and NTSC, because what we had was a PAL Hi8 camera or something, and we were doing this doco drama, and, you know, we were really pushing visually what we were trying to do, have this time headquarters where everything was blown out whites. And then, you know, we're dealing with inside clock towers and then out on the streets talking to all the people. And, you know, we recorded on Niagara's. It was a heady time to be a film student.
So you had this fantastic film school experience in New York and then came back to Australia with the intention of getting into the industry here as a director.
Yes. I realised that now that I'd had my film school training and I had all this experience in Tokyo, that I was going to come back to Australia and figure out how to make it as a director in Australia. It turns out it's not so easy.
So the key thing, I think, in the way that unfolded for you was a short film called Sugar Ink.
Yes, it was huge. So I did have to, you know, just to make ends meet, go back into production, because that's where my experience was. And I was lucky that I worked with Glenys Rowe and Chris Noonan at Binnenborough Films. And they taught me a lot about how things worked in Australia. And Chris in particular was very generous with his knowledge and, you know, said, look, why don't you just pop in at Framesetter Match and I'll show you how post works. And it was a wonderful opportunity. And then there was a Japanese-Australian production company. So I started working as production manager or producer on a couple of those TV commercials. And on one of the commercials, I ended up meeting another producer who was where I was, you know, wanting to actually do a short, do something. And she said to me, why don't we do something together? And so I came up with this story that I'd always wanted to write because it was all about desserts and about the magic desserts. And anyone who knows me knows I have a sweet tooth.
And you also love sci-fi.
Yes, although I wouldn't really call Sugar Inc. that sci-fi.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a little bit out there, but it's more about this world. And this was before MasterChef, and I decided I have my master chef. My flatmate at the time was an old uni friend of mine, and he was a lawyer. And he was telling me once about the process of getting into certain companies and how hard it was, how many layers of interviews that you had to go through to get there. And it stayed with me, and I thought, what if I make this about the desserts world? What sort of story would I end up having? So anyway, I wrote this really wacky script, and then the producer sent it out to one of the cinematographers that she really admired and thought would be perfect for this. And that cinematographer was Gary Wapshot.
And that turned out to be, I think, your first great collaboration with a cinematographer.
It really was. Gary's a massive foodie as well. And he really understood this wacky world that I was trying to create. Mm. And so, yeah, this film that we ended up shooting on 35mm ended up being very successful on the International Film Festival circuit. And it was such an extraordinary moment realizing when the crew started referring to certain images, because I kept a very thick visual reference folder of music and photos and everything, of something being very Sugar Inky. This is, you know, this is like a Sugar Inker. And yeah, it's just, oh, it's the heady world of filmmaking. You realize how much of an impact it can make and how many people responded to the film.
And the fact that the film did work so well, that really got you opportunities to move into TV commercials as a director.
Yes, because at the same time that I was approached by a production company to rep me for directing work, that was Prodigy Films, I was also working at National Geographic Channel as a promo producer, where I also ended up doing several documentaries. We did a series called Framed, which is like a mini documentary about behind the scenes on Nat Geo. So I wrote, directed and edited that. And then I wrote, directed and edited the first season of Nat Geo Presents. And then I did a long form doco that I wrote and directed called Oztrek with Jack Thompson, which was another extraordinary story.
Mm. And so this is still in that period of time where, while there was a little bit of crossover, and I was one of those people that was crossing over between digital and film, on the whole there was a fairly deep divide between, there was the people who worked with film and
yes,
there was the people who worked with tape.
Yes.
And so I guess you were collaborating with cinematographers on both sides of that. You were working with people who were shooting tape on the Nat Geo side for documentaries, and then working with people shooting film for commercials.
Absolutely. But also, you know, this is about round about the time that we met, and you were very much leading the way with HD technology, and it was interesting. I still remember the first time we met, where you were at Film Australia talking about this short film that you'd made, and I remember thinking, this is the way of the future. This is where it's all going, because film, I love film and I love everything that you can do with film. But it is very expensive, and it's very difficult to do on your own. You need to have so many other people in the process to help you get that project made with film. Whereas with digital, things were becoming a lot more accessible. And as a young filmmaker, you just want to make films. You have to experiment in order to get better.
Mm. And the big thing for me, as somebody who was kind of working their way out of shooting tape and trying to concentrate on shooting film, when HD and digital came along, I wasn't prepared to give up the working methods of film just because this was a camera that was an electronic camera. So one of the things that I put a lot of time into in the lead up to that short film was, how can I make digital and the process of working with it as much like film as possible? And I think the results of that, when they were on screen, really surprised a lot of people.
Definitely, because you're bringing a cinematic approach to the new digital technology, and people were thinking that you had to treat digital in a completely different way. Digital had its own digital way of doing things, And I think now with hindsight, you realise that, no, filmmaking is filmmaking. You still need to give it the proper respect that it needs. You still need to light a shot. You still need to frame it properly. You still need to move it properly. But the technology that allows you to do all of those things have changed so much. So there are a lot more choices out there, both economical and still on the big scale, big toy scale of things that you can choose to do.
Yeah. So around that time, you moved to being repped by a production company in Melbourne called Tribal.
Yes.
And that's where we started to move from doing these small creative projects together to working pretty consistently on commercials together.
Yeah, with the big crews and the big toys and everything. And what was really interesting, it was such a wonderful time. We had a fantastic production company, and the producer, Sharon Maloney, was so freeing. I think creativity is really all about the freedom to actually create. Mm. And you're always going to get the best work when you have that freedom. And
she was always very protective of the creative process.
Yes. And with advertising, I learned the hard way again. You think as a director, when you're given a brief to do a director's treatment for a commercial, that, oh, I can make this so much better, and you just change it all. But that doesn't work with advertising, because what you don't know and you have to learn very quickly is that it's already gone through a massive process of being written and being commented on by the client, between the client and the advertising agency. So by the time it actually gets to you as a director, they want to do.
Yeah.
So you just have to figure out the best way to make that original, but stick to the brief.
Yeah, and add to it, but don't change it.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's a strategy for paid work, paid projects, where I'm hired as a director, that I've always kept to since I learned that lesson. And you've got to fulfill that. You've got to know who's the target audience. You've got to know what's the style. What do they want the viewer to feel from, you know, whether it's the ad or whatever it is that you're doing.
Mm.
And you've got to make sure that you know how all the elements work. And again, that is a skill that you get better and better at. I think when you start, post-production in particular is quite a scary area to go into, because, you know, suddenly you're working with hues and saturation and shadows and contrast, and how you work with all of that when you're starting off, how do you understand all of that? And the truth is, when you're starting off, you don't.
Mm.
But you know the image you want, you know the style you want, and you've already communicated this with your DOP at the beginning. And when you get into post, it's then learning the language. And I think once you start to learn the language, okay, you want to crush the shadows here, you want to increase chroma, or you just learn the vignetting, what you want in a shot, how, and the different levels of what you can work with. And that's where I've been lucky, because we've kind of evolved together there. And in Melbourne, that during that time was the first time we started color graded the ads that we were doing there. So I had this crash course in understanding what that meant, how far I could push things. And as the technology has gotten better and better, I've gotten better at explaining exactly what I want as well. I know, you know that I like the lower grad, the lower third of screen, and you know that with certain things I like a little bit more heavier vignetting, and other things, you know, you track the eyelight or whatever it is. It's just learning the language of how to talk to a colorist, and in a way that he or she understands the visual images that you want to present.
Mm. A lot of that's just kind of working out a shorthand to communicate that stuff as well. And that's I think a big part of the director cinematographer relationship. So around that time, I had already been doing a bit with color grading in Final Cut Pro when it had some very basic color correction controls in there from version 3 onwards. And I had already done a TV film for SBS Network that was done in the production company that was making that film. And that TV film was done in the studio of the production company down in Hobart, because they owned their own uncompressed Final Cut suite. And so we were able to do that. And it literally meant we had 3 days to grade it instead of 3 hours. And so I'd been kind of working with this for a while. And then I think it was about 2004 that there was a commercial that you had pitched on successfully, and then the client cut the budget suddenly. So we went from we were going to be shooting on film, and then suddenly we were shooting that digitally. But also we were going to have very, very limited time in the Da Vinci color grading suite. And so this was the opportunity where we kind of said to the production company, what about we do this in one of your Final Cut suites? And it was a very slow process back then.
Mm, I remember waiting for renders.
But even with all those time constraints of waiting for renders to do anything, basically, it still gave us a lot more creative freedom. We still had more creative options because we could spend the time on it.
Yes.
And I think for us and the production company and the ad agency and the client, it became such a freeing experience that I don't think we ever really went back after that.
No, I think that was the start of our way of working and developing our own workflow for projects. And I think what we also learnt was the classic development pre, production post became very intertwined in the new way that we started to work. Because when I'm given a project to pitch on and then we get it, the first thing I have to do is the research on how I'm going to bring this all together. I think not many people really understand what a director does.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
I think it's very easy to understand what a cinematographer does because you're there with a camera, you can see you're moving, you can see you lighting, et cetera, that shot. But a director looks like they're just on set talking.
Mm.
And
yeah, I think a lot of people, definitely people outside the industry, but even a lot of people in the industry think that the director's job is primarily watching what's going on and saying whether they like it or not.
Exactly. During production, that's very much the case. You know, you are, but it's also if you don't understand all the other processes that we're talking about earlier about editing or producing, you don't know, you know, it's when you're there on set and something happens. Something always happens. You run out of time, the weather's changing, there's always something unexpected that happens. The actor may not be available until a bit later or whatever that is, and you've got to make it work. You've got to make sure that you're not wasting money on set and still getting other shots that you can get in the meantime. Or adjusting a shot, you may not be able to get the whole master shot. So what shots do you need to make that scene work? And if you don't understand, you need that wide shot, you need an establishing shot, you need a certain number of cutaways, you need a couple of choices so that when you do get into the edit, you can still make the scene work. And if you don't understand that as a director, then you're going to waste time shooting reams of footage that you'll never use.
It's one of the things I've noticed about working with you in contrast to some other directors that I've worked with, some very good ones. I've never seen uncertainty with you about whether you've got it or not. And I think that's partly to do with the fact that you've always edited.
Well, I learned editing from the best. So it was, again, a great way to get to that stage of realizing, actually, you know what? I've seen enough of the button pushing to realize I can do that. And it's on the projects that you want to do for love that you know, you don't want to call in favours all the time. So, you know, you start experimenting and seeing, can I do this? And because I enjoyed that process, I found it a lot faster just to edit myself than to speak to an editor to ask them to do that. But that also evolved because, you know, we've spoken a lot about the animatics and how crucial they are to the way I work. I don't use them on everything, but certainly for anything with drama, I definitely use an animatic.
So let's talk through that process that you go through preparing for a shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's actually, I think, a much bigger part of the director's job than people kind of realise who haven't observed it up close. And I know that this, for most successful directors, the preparation for a shoot is a huge part of their job.
Absolutely, because, okay, so you're given a script and actually this happens from the moment that you start to pitch for a film. That's pretty much that process because you have to know that the director's treatment has to be something because there's never enough time once it becomes a go project to redo anything or explain things. You've just got to go very, very quickly into actual production. So that director's treatment for me becomes the Bible to explain everything about the visual style, the tone, the pacing, the characters, the wardrobe, the like everything that, you know, is in my head as to how to pull this off is in that director's treatment. In order to do that, I need lots of visual references. I need to work out exactly what I'm going to tell the all the collaborators, the heads of department. So from visual references to music, I'm very sensory in that if I might hear something that I go, oh, I know that if we get the feeling like this bit of music or this, you know, bit of accent, and then there's a colour palette that evolves. But that sometimes, you know, involves me watching through iTunes lots and lots of different films or whatever it is that I've had. But I've also, you know, I've done this as far back as I can remember. I've always either kept scrapbooks in the beginning of visuals that I've always loved, so I can always refer to them when I'm looking for a particular look. I never know when I'm going to use it, which is why I collect all of those visual references. But nowadays you've got Instagram, so I just, you know, save it to a folder where I call it a certain type of visual or dance or whatever it happens to be. And there's certain colour palettes within that I've looked at over the years that I've liked, and I'm never sure when I'm going to use it, but I'll file it away for future use. And so all of that becomes part of my package of bringing things together. And then I will still, you know, trawl the internet looking for other images that are useful. And then I start to structure it together in my director's treatment. And that's that process of structuring it also helps me work out what is it about the framing that I like about this. And it's really, it's a process of elimination. I realise, no, I don't want that. I want it to be warmer. I want it to have cooler mid-tones. I want it to crop short. I don't want so much movement on this one. This one needs a lot more style. And then you start to work out the sounds or the rhythm of the music that you're looking for. And you know, I've worked with some amazing composers over my career, from Stuart Darrieta to Paul Wynn to Carlo Giacco. And each of these musicians and composers bring, you know, they bring their own ideas to the table as well. And that's where, as a director, you have to be confident of this is the tone I want, and explaining that, and then letting them do their jobs, letting each of the heads of department do their jobs. I'm much more happier if I've said, you know, for example, on the Taronga shoot with Sam Wilde, for HQ, where we had to have quite a bunker, this sci-fi bunker where all the work, you know, underneath the zoo gets done. And I remember, you know, I had all these visual references and style diagrams that I showed Sam, and then he came back and said, do you think you might want a plinth? I'm like, what the hell's a plinth? And it turned out it was perfect, you know, and I now know what a plinth is. But it's that world of collaboration where you've said enough for that person to go away and start to think about other things that could still help.
Yeah, and to be able to brief someone well enough that they can then interpret from that. One of the strongest memories I have from our early collaborations is we were in pre-production on a short film, and one of the things you said to me was, I want this scene to look like this piece of music sounds. And I just thought, wow, I can work with that. I
still remember that one. That was Shadow Dream.
Yeah. And it's because so much of visuals is very difficult to communicate about when you get into the fine detail of it. You know, kind of it's very easy to say, oh, well, that chair is red. I want that chair to be red. But beyond that, when you start getting into the real in-depth detail of visuals and how they come across on screen, the layers of complexity is kind of beyond normal language to communicate about. And that's where I think it's so effective the way you work with visual references and other things like music as a reference, because music communicates emotion so well.
And going back to that process, so the visual references then form the basis of a placeholder animatic that I have. So once I work out from the visual references the type of style that I want to do, then I can then pick out the music and the structure of the whole project. And
I think that's a product of you as a director who edits, you bringing that into the pre-production process, where you're actually going into the editing software and recording audio and grabbing music and effects and putting images in there to figure out the flow of what you need.
I think that structure also comes from understanding that it is about visuals, but it's also equally about audio. It's about how you package that all together as a storyteller. But then what you also need to do is sometimes you may not be working with actors. We did A Place for Every Story last year where everything was about a location. But I had to figure out how to bring emotion into this story about locations. And that was a very difficult challenge. And even though I had an animatic, I think what was really interesting about that particular project was because I didn't have the actor to show me the emotions and have that journey with the actor, and I had to have that in the locations. For a lot of it, I actually had to wait until we were at the location to start see the shots evolve and then how I could use that to bring some emotion into it. And that's that bringing emotion into your story, I think that differentiates you as a director in how well the story is going to be told, because at the end of the day, we're entertainers, but, you know, the type of stories that I want to tell are stories that make you feel something or make you feel inspired. So it's a very, it's a layered approach where you do learn. Detail helps you with emotion, and even through the sounds. I remember the breaths in one bit of music. Carla composed this gorgeous piece, but I realised it was still lacking something with emotion. And I realised if you just bring like a female breath, I wanted that, you know, through that, and it just elevates it. And I think so much about audio is underrated sometimes. The power of audio is so huge. If you get that click right, if you get the crackle or whatever it is, all of these are subconscious clues as to how you want the audience to feel through the journey of that project.
Yeah, and I think it's fantastic the way it's so practical now for you to be exploring those things and those ideas right from the very beginning of a project before we've even shot anything. It's not an afterthought like sound often is. And often had to be in years gone by. But you can now be putting in sound effects and audio cues for the audience right from the very beginning of your preparation, and that will flow through. If they keep working, they flow through the whole sound design and mixing process.
And most times it does do that. All the sound effects that I've found at the beginning are still there at the end, and I might change my mind about certain ones, but it's pretty much, you know, the animatic is, I'd say, about 70-80% intact still by the end of it. The things that change in the animatic are usually more to do with the acting, that I want to add a couple more beats to make sure that transition works. And if an actor is, you know, so good that I don't want to cut away, then I'll happily lose another shot there and let that, you know, that go. But the other thing I've learned over the years, which you don't like so much as a cinematographer, is I'll always choose performance over the shot being perfect.
I don't like it, but I know it's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is, because the performance is the most important thing. And if the performance is not right and it's not connecting for the audience, then none of the rest of it really matters that much.
Exactly. I think in the beginning when you're just starting out, style kind of almost matters more than substance, because you're so keen to have a strong visual style and a directorial approach to things. And I think it's only through experience and time and life experience. Some people get it younger. For me, it happened much later, where I had a strong visual style, but what it lacked was the heart, the emotion. And it evolves. And for me, definitely having had kids has certainly changed a lot of how I look at things as a director and what I look for in a story and what I look for with the characters and how they evolve.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely brought out a whole other level in your directing that I've certainly noticed.
You also have to get a lot quicker at things. I think pre-kids, you always think, oh, God, I'm so efficient. I can do this. I can do that. And then when you have kids and you're literally juggling between feeding and just the chaos of life, it's amazing. Until this year, you know, we pretty much had to juggle 3 days of our oldest going to school, and then we had a preschooler that only went to preschool Monday to Wednesday. So Thursday, Friday, we're constantly juggling and tag teaming. And it's remarkable at how much you can keep going within that short period of time.
Yeah, one of the things that really strikes me about that is storyboarding. And you used to agonize over storyboards for a much, much longer time period than you do now, whereas now you're just diving in and working very, very rapidly on storyboards.
I think you also trust yourself more now because I know what it takes to cut together a scene. I know what it takes. I guess that brings us also to the multitasking or multi-slashies where I wrote initially to make sure that I could direct.
In order to have something to direct.
Yeah, yeah, because you can't pay a writer for it at the time. But, and, you know, with all your low-budget projects, that's how I probably ended up editing. And, you know, I've been doing that for now, what, 15 years. But I do it now because I know I'm fast and I enjoy it, but it also, all of those elements help you direct. A director is not just directing. You have to understand about the writing process, the producing process, the editing process. You have to understand production design, lighting, lenses, all those skills that your heads of department have, but you need to understand it at such a complex level so that you're communicating your brief to them so that they can do that.
So you've had this amazing 25-year career in the industry and you've had some incredible mentors, had some amazing opportunities, worked in multiple countries around the world. And did you have any idea going into it how unlikely that would be as an Asian female? Because statistically it is one of the most underrepresented groups in film directing in the world.
Yeah, it's taken me a long time to come to terms with that one. And it's hard to really, you know, complain because I do get a lot of opportunity that I know that other directors may not get. And yet it's interesting that, and I only know through hindsight because of the type of projects I've done and what it's led to or what it hasn't led to.
And it's not like you've had terrible experiences. You've been treated very well by crews, treated very well by clients and agencies and producers, and you have had some fantastic opportunities.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of within that context. And what's striking about that is when you do get the chance to pitch on something, you've got this incredible strike rate of being successful.
You know, we've looked back at the projects that I've won and realised actually, especially in recent years, it's been a 90% track record of winning the pitches that I'm invited to pitch. And it was only when we were doing a project where they were talking about gender issues and they were talking about merit.
Unconscious bias and merit.
And pre-doing that project, I'd already written an op-ed about opportunity and equality as a female director. And I was like, come on, it's got to be about merit. Absolutely, it's got to be about merit. We grew up as Generation Xs, so it's like put your head down, work hard, and you'll get success.
Stand on your own two
feet. Yeah, yeah. As a female ethnic minority director, people look at me and expect me to be a lifestyle or a kids or a food director. And I didn't mind that because, hey, I was getting work, so I was trying that. But
when we heard all that stuff about unconscious bias and merit and I realised there was a pattern that I saw with your career that also fits with the career of several of my female cinematographer friends. And the thing about that was that it's success not leading to the next opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, so you'd excel with one type of work. So, for example, you know, excel with lifestyle commercials and never get the chance to pitch on cars or tourism or more prestige kind of work. And that's where I think the unconscious bias comes in. It's not people at the client or agency going, oh, we don't want to work with her because she's female or Asian. It's this unconscious bias of not even thinking of you for those jobs or just going, oh, yeah, this is not her style. We want him or him.
Wouldn't it be interesting if every pitch that you did didn't have your name on it and it just came with the actual pitch itself?
Yeah.
That would be quite interesting. I think would change a lot of ways a director was chosen for a job. But I think the biggest example that I remember we talked about was I was approached by the production company because this was a massive international job. Their whole reference as to going after this job was
the ad agency's point of reference for the style that they wanted.
Was a commercial that I'd done, and this is a cinema commercial that I'd done
that I wrote and directed.
So I came up with a whole creative concept of, and so it was very exciting because it was such a So prestige job.
Yeah, the production company that was one of the production companies pitching on this job had the very clever idea of, okay, this is the visual, the one style reference that the client and ad agency have agreed on. Why don't we get the director who did that? We get the actual person who did that reference. And so we were very excited about it and very happy to be represented by this overseas production company for
Absolutely.
Pitching on that.
Yep.
And then what happened?
And then they discovered that I was me. I was female. I was Asian. And
from that point, we never heard back from them.
No. And I didn't get a chance to pitch on the one project that I was the reference for. So that was a huge wake-up call going, okay, there is something going on here. And
I think with that one, I mean, you got close to pitching but still didn't get to pitch. But I think the problem for a lot of female minority creatives is that it's the projects that you never even hear about, that you never get the chance to pitch on, that you never kind of know are out there.
In my writing, the scripts that I write, they never have an ethnicity. Mm. And I've fought that because I want to be able to cast the right, or even
keep
when I'm reading
open.
A script, I keep it open. It's like, let's see who's good and then work out how we're going to make this work and tell the best story. And I remember on a recent project, I cast the child first, and the child I cast just happened to be white. But then some of the backlash that we got about that project was it was whitewashing. Yeah. And it's just so ironic to think,
it was never the intention. It's just the perfect
child
actor
that I cast, and so I had to create the family
around
her. And it was also interesting because I thought, okay, what could I have done it that differently? Could I have, maybe made it more ethnically diverse within the family? But then I'm thinking, then you would have been so, hung up on why was the father or the mother, or the brother not looking anything remotely like the child? So, and that distracts from the actual story.
Yep. And in contrast to that, if you don't specify, you maybe as director and writer may be thinking of this could be any one of a number of nationalities playing this role. But there's also the possibility that a lot of people in the industry will read it and just imagine.
That's the problem that I think it was a recent finding. It was either the Annenberg Institute or it was the Gina Davis, where she was talking about actually the easiest way to fix that is to literally write into your extras they were women or they were, African American or whatever it is, so that there is no – it will ensure that when it comes to casting, those roles will be filled by diverse actors.
Yeah.
And so I've now, with the scripts that I'm writing, I'm putting in – an ethnically diverse character only so that I can ensure that one of them will be. I don't
so that
know
it doesn't
how
get overlooked.
Yeah. And it may not mean that I'm going to cast them specifically that way, but I want to make sure that it's open there, that this is not just an all-white cast. That's also led to a very diverse slate that we now have. One of the earlier scripts that I wrote was pre-Me Too movement, three female leads in a workplace, how females relate to each other. And we're taught in society to bitch about each other, and that's not okay.
Yeah. I think there's a tendency for society to encourage women to be, especially in the workplace, very competitive with each other, in a way where men are much more likely to have each other's back.
It is interesting because I worked with so many men early on in my career. It wasn't until I got back to Australia that I really started working with females, and that's where I was so shocked at this female-female rivalry that I'd never seen before. And because I was working in Japan where it's all flowery language, it's all very polite and very humble. And then I went to New York where everything's, whoa, over the top, and you just say what you think. And so I had to learn to adapt my personality as well from the very Japanese private side and then go into New York and make sure that I was telling them
what
as it was.
Needed,
not in a flowery language.
Because they wouldn't get it.
No.
And so you learning to adapt to those different work environments.
Yeah. And then you also start to think, okay, maybe my story is to find other ways of doing it. And, you've got to adapt. I mean, that's what we pride ourselves on as well. You've got to be nimble and adapt to the environment around you and work out if that door closes, how do you make the next one open and how do you keep making it next one open?
And that's why we've chosen to self-fund the development of our slate of long-form projects, both feature films and TV series. And there's a wonderful degree of control that comes with that.
For sure, because I do write and direct and you produce and shoot, it means that we're able to take these projects to a much greater level without having to bring in other people, even though we do have a fantastic team.
When you do have those great creative collaborations working with people, you want to keep working with them again and again and again because it's just such a fantastic process.
We like to think of ourselves as decent people who want to treat people properly. And that's where, you know, when we have interns or when we have assistants come, we want to show them the way that we like to work, which isn't antagonistic, which doesn't involve yelling in long hours and the stuff that you can't sustain because, when you're young, you can do anything. You can work 23-hour days if you had to.
Yep. I think there's a lot of things like those crazy working hours and an aggressive culture on set that are certainly not universal across the industry, but they're a very big part of the industry in certain sectors. And I think it's become more and more apparent to us as time goes on that it doesn't have to be that way.
And especially having kids, you just can't make that work. You can't do those crazy hours and keep a family. You do what you can. We've had breastfeeding breaks for the babies that we've had. And
it's amazing how accepting of that people can be.
Yeah, but I think that's also part of making things normal. We used to always say we're in a meeting or someone stepped out or, you know, if we're doing something kid related.
Yep. But just happened to be in a meeting at 3 o'clock every afternoon.
Yeah. And what we realize is, you know what, if we're going to change the culture, we have to do our little bit for it by saying what we're doing and being honest about it. So if a client does say, can we make it at 3 o'clock, saying, you know, sorry, we're doing school pickup then.
I think that's something that, tell me I'm wrong with this, but I think in some ways that's even harder for men to do than women because this expectation that men are focused on work and career and all that stuff and women sometimes get a little bit more slack on that. So
I think that maybe women used to, but I think our generation, it's very, very common for men and women to look after the family. I mean, you just have to go to school pickup and see how many fathers are out there to know it's a completely normal thing. For us, where we are, maybe that's different if you live somewhere else, but for where we are in Sydney, it's a very normal thing to do.
And certainly the thing that I found when we had that realization as part of that whole equality and diversity, merit and unconscious bias conversation, that part of fixing that stuff is normalizing these things. And we made that very conscious decision to start being open with people about when we're meeting family commitments.
Yeah.
And it was very scary for me to start doing that. No, I'm just realizing now it's probably more internal fear than external pressure. But what's really surprised me in the few years since having that realization is that I have been telling people, okay, sorry, I'm about to go and do school pickup. I'll have to call you back in an hour, that kind of thing. And people are very understanding in general. And the number of people whose reaction is, oh, great. And people are very warm about that.
Or Easter hat parade or whatever it happens to be. But I think the other thing is because we do have our own production company, we are able to bring that into our productions as well. The crews that we have certainly have young families, and so when we do the longer form projects, we need to be able to do it in a way that is sustainable for all of us because we all have private lives and we want to balance that better and see our kids. And so if we're going to do that, and filmmaking is hard and it is grueling. And so we have had shoots where we can say to the crew, you can bring your kids on this one.
Yep.
Because it's a family friendly set where we're not using that audio or, you know, it's not always the case because you're shooting dialogue.
But when it is possible, it's a wonderful thing to be able to offer people.
Yes. We've squeezed all the equipment back home because we initially had an office just across the courtyard from us. We had everything set up. But when our oldest was a baby, because we worked together on so much and particularly in post where I have to oversee so much.
Where it takes both of us to be looking at a colour grade or listening to a sound mix.
Given the way we work with our clients nowadays, it's very much you go meet them at their offices and
then they want to click on a link. They don't want to come in and sit up the back of the edit suite the way they used to.
And when we do have a project that needs it, then we just hire an office, and it's a lot more fluid way of working.
Yeah. It's not uncommon for us to have an idea in the evening and go and do a little bit of work just because we've had the idea at that time, and you don't have to go into the office to do that. And it might be, you know, there's been recent things where I've had an idea about another layer of something to add to a LUT. Mm. And so I fire up the DaVinci machine and go in and do that while the idea is fresh.
And while the kids are still there, they might be asleep or they might be on your knee looking at another cut. They've grown up watching how an edit comes together, hearing the same bit of music. They recite all the dialogue in our scripts because they've heard it so many times over and over.
And to them it's completely normal. And I think there's something wonderful about that. I think it's a way we would have both been very happy to grow up.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's a childhood that we never had. But so far they're not complaining.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the exciting things about where the technology has been going, that that's becoming more and more practical and much more easy to be able to have, you know, full post-production in your house. Mm. You know, because when we started doing commercials together, to be able to do that at the level that we're able to do it now, you would literally be talking about spending millions of dollars and having huge amounts of space to be able to set that up, to be able to do that kind of, particularly the grading and mixing. Mm. And so, you know, we routinely do mixes with hundreds of channels in them on a system that doesn't have a huge footprint in the house.
Mm. But I think also a lot of the way we're choosing to work now and what we're implementing into our workplaces is a reflection of the world we live in now and the pressures that are facing the world. Climate change is a huge part of that. So our environmental policy, honouring the Indigenous culture of Australia.
These are things that aren't just being tacked on, but we're actually getting more and more familiar with deeply embedding them in the whole way that we work.
Yeah, because I think there's a responsibility in being a filmmaker today of still writing stories to entertain, but being conscious of, you know, what's real. And people, I think, are really craving good, for want of a better word, because there's just so much bad stuff out there and there's so much scary stuff out there. And it's so much to make you angry and feeling unsure of things. So I guess with the type of projects that we're drawn to for us as parents but as filmmakers in this world are stories that you can have fun, that, you know, have a sense of humour and fun but also inspire and make you feel good.
Mm,
and that doesn't mean like a rom-com. It's just a good story told well and told with heart.
I think there's... As a ethnic minority female director, we both feel that you, and by extension of that, me, have a heightened responsibility to be aware of these issues and to take action on these issues.
Yes, and I think since that government job where we learnt about gender equality and gender bias, and one of the most striking examples they gave was, I think it was a Philharmonic Orchestra in New York, and they did blind auditions where they literally had a screen in between the judges and the musicians, and the results of who they chose in the end was
vastly different to the
it was
track
completely different. Yeah. And even me, as that has biases, I'd only worked with a female first assistant director for the first time last year, and that's a bias I had, because when I was presented with a female name, I was like, oh.
And you were taken aback for a moment.
Yeah, I couldn't figure out why I was taken aback. And then I had to think, hang on a minute, okay.
That's an unconscious bias.
It is an unconscious bias. Yeah. And this was given to me by a female producer that I've been working with, who I respected very much. So I knew I was taking all of the suggestions seriously. And she put this particular first AD as one of the top ones there. So I had to just get over it, basically.
Yeah, and she was fantastic.
Yeah, she was awesome.
You know, one of the best we've worked with. And I think the big thing that shows is the most important step in fixing unconscious bias is to become conscious of it.
And which is why also, as unnatural as it feels, I'm referring to myself as a female ethnic minority director, just so that becomes a bit more normal to say. Yeah. And I'm still grappling with how to get comfortable about that. But
because you really want to present yourself as a director, just as a director, and stand by your work. But it's also to be part of making these positive changes happen in the world and in the industry. You've got to be more visible with acknowledging that.
And who I am and the type of people that I want to work with, both within the crew and the cast. I think you can talk about diversity and inclusivity, but a lot of it, as wonderful as it is with the Me Too and the increased attention on diversity and inclusion, there's a part of that that's also very political. It's like ticking off, oh, okay, we've got, you know, this one's already, you know, got an ethnic minority here, so we don't need it in that section.
Yep.
And so I think it's very easy to have become lip service.
Yes.
And I think the only way we can make it, again, changing the culture, changing the way we think about it, is to talk openly about it. And if that means I've got to keep referring to myself as a female ethnic minority director, then I'll keep doing that, because it helps the next
Asian
or, you know, African or whatever it is, realize actually no, it's fine to talk about it that way, because it's part of your background. It's what makes you who you are.
Yeah. On that note, Clara, thank you for stopping in.
Thank you.